I'm here to chair this fabulous, fabulous session called Pittsburgh Personalities, Rediscovering Ted Lewis, Rare Recordings from the Ted Lewis Museum, featuring the talents of Brian Wright, the Errol Garner Jazz Legacy Project, I'll announce each one separately when we're ready to roll. I will announce each presenter, and then we'll have the presentation. If there's any time left at the end, you can catch the people or however. And third one, the enigmatic David Eisenzahn. Is that how it's pronounced? Okay, there you go. Looking at the wrong person. by Ben Young, and The Life and Legacy of Oscar Levant by Russ Miller. So we're going to start off the gang with the first presentation by, here we go, I got to get all my paper together here. Brian Wright is a Ph. candidate in historical musicology at the University of Pittsburgh, where he is also a part-time instructor. He is the founder and executive producer of Rivermont Records, a Grammy-nominated label specializing in vintage music reissues and new recordings of ragtime traditional jazz and related musical styles on both CD and vinyl. A pianist himself specializing in ragtime and early jazz, he has performed internationally as far afield as Japan, France, Argentina, and beyond. In addition to ragtime festivals across the United States, and in 2013, he was appointed artist in residence for the Scott Joplin International Ragtime Foundation. Brian is an avid collector of 78 RPM records and hosts a bi-weekly podcast, The Shellac Stack, featuring 78s from his collection. So we're going to talk in Pennsylvania about an Ohio-born musician. Thank you.
Thank you. Yes, it's a little odd to talk about Ted Lewis in a local music-themed session, but Ted Lewis was born in Circleville, Ohio, came to Pittsburgh a lot, so he's of regional interest, so we can just put it that way. Before I start, I'd like to say thanks to some people who aren't here but who really made my presentation possible, among them Joyce Keller, the president of the Ted Lewis Museum, Joseph Rubin, their curator, and Mark Beresford and Nick Dello over in England, two gentlemen who have spent a long time researching, writing about Ted Lewis, and I owe a lot of my presentation today to them. So, in the small city of Circleville, Ohio, some 30 miles south of Columbus, in the oldest remaining building within the circular geologic feature that gave the city its name, is the Ted Lewis Museum. Perhaps some of you have been there. Founded in 1977 by Ted's widow, Ada, the tiny museum, staffed by volunteers, displays memorabilia from Ted's 65-year career and doubles as a repository for Ted's own collection of papers, recordings, musical arrangements, and other effects. Last summer, I made the pilgrimage there to retrieve some unique test pressings and one-of-a-kind air checks for a CD reissue that I was working on in conjunction with the museum. As someone with a keen interest in American popular music of the early 20th century, I thought I was fairly familiar with Ted Lewis's work. I had a healthy respect and appreciation for him as a successful showman, but years of reading the ill-informed and often prejudiced opinions of so-called jazz experts who routinely maligned or ignored Ted Lewis had tarnished my estimation of his musical talents and importance. As I followed Joyce Keller, the museum's president, down a flight of stairs to the basement where the non-display items are kept, I'll admit I did so only half-heartedly. I imagined myself hauling out a dozen or so 16-inch discs caked in white greasy powder, painstakingly cleaning and transferring them, only to salvage another dozen versions of When My Baby Smiles at Me. Not that I dislike the song or Ted's rendition of it, but it's hardly the kind of fare that sets my heart racing. Yanking a couple dangling pull chains to illuminate the ceiling-mounted incandescence, Joyce showed me to a shelf in the middle of the dark, smallish room with a couple dozen generic 78 RPM record albums. Pulling one out and carefully turning its pages, I noticed that it was filled with 12-inch lacquer discs bearing typed or handwritten labels identifying radio broadcasts originating at stations or networks across the country from the 1930s through the 1950s. Ted Lewis's personal archive of his appearances, many of them existing nowhere else. Joyce and I pulled the albums off the shelf one by one, examining the contents of each in search of specific broadcasts that the museum's curator, Joseph Rubin, had asked me to locate and transfer. Too often, opening an album was accompanied by the sickening clink-clink of glass fragments. At some time in their 70 years, a number of the glass-based discs had been reduced to pocketfuls of nasty shards. Taking care not to damage them or myself any further, I retrieved those still in one piece, cleaned, and prepared them for transfer. And while some, like a 1947 pilot for a Ted Lewis radio show, a 1949 Voice of the Army program, and others, were about what I expected, an older Ted Lewis reflecting on his earlier successes and speak-singing his way through 30 or 40-year-old songs to lush, if generic, accompaniment, several of the programs surprised me and forced me to reconsider what I thought I knew of the hi-hat tragedian of song. Over the next 8 months, working with Joseph Rubin, Mark Beresford, and Nick Dello to prepare the aforementioned CD, I noticed that despite all that's been written about Ted's early jazz-oriented years, the mid to late 1930s represent a relative dark age in his career. The conventional wisdom has been that after a string of propulsive, I'll call them proto-swing records for Decca in 1934, Ted Lewis, then in his mid-40s, and a decade or two older than the vanguard of popular band leaders, eschewed changing fashions and music, choosing instead to cater to an aging audience of longtime fans with nostalgia-oriented programs that centered around his tried-and-true routines like Me and My Shadow and When My Baby Smiles at Me. While those fixtures did indeed remain, contemporary reports and Ted's private recordings reveal that he also strove to keep his shows fresh, regularly introducing new performers and adapting to newer musical trends like swing. For starters, at least through the end of the 1930s, his billing in newspapers and other publicity was as the hi-hat tragedian of jazz, not song, as it would become in the 1940s. So the purpose of my talk today is threefold. First, to share with you a few of my discoveries from the basement of the Ted Lewis Museum. Second, to draw attention to the need for Ted Lewis's collection of aluminum and glass-based air checks to be transferred to the digital domain. While the museum doesn't have the means to pay for such work right now, perhaps someone here would be willing to take on the task as a public service or know someone who might. I've only touched the tip of the iceberg. The vast majority of the collection remains to be digitized. If you can help, I'm sure Joseph Rubin at the museum would be very pleased to hear from you. Finally, I wish to add my voice to those calling for a reappraisal of Ted Lewis, the musician and band leader. Time has not been kind to him. Eddie Condon was hardly the first to take jabs at his musical talents when he quipped that, quote, Ted Lewis could make the clarinet talk. What it said was, put me back in the case. By Ted's own admission, he was no virtuoso, but his abilities as a musician have, I think, been underrated. Rob Bamberger, who's sitting over here, has observed that Ted's trademark gas pipe clarinet style was a deliberate choice and not necessarily an indicator of lack of technique. As a clarinetist, Ted was influenced to some degree by klezmer and other Jewish music he undoubtedly heard as a boy. He came from a Jewish family, and Rob has noted at least a cousinship between gas pipe clarinet and klezmer. Ted also heard other early jazz bands with clarinetists who favored the shrill, vibrato-laden sound of an overblown clarinet, which enabled it to be heard among the other instruments in a raucous ensemble like the original Dixieland Jazz Band. If we are to wonder why Ted Lewis played the way he did, Robs writes, it cannot be explained away as a lack of technique. He must have played gas pipe because he chose to. For those who may not be familiar with the basic narrative of Ted Lewis's 65-year career, I'll offer a brief summary of the early years. Born in Circleville, Ohio in 1890, he became fascinated by music and show business while he was still a child. He studied piccolo and clarinet and played in the Circleville Boys Band. To his parents' dismay, young Ted showed little interest in formal education or working in the family's department store, and at 15, he and his brother Edgar developed a routine called the Musical Twins that made the rounds of the local Gus Sun vaudeville circuit. For the next decade, working with various partners, Ted traveled throughout much of the United States and into Canada, often nearly penniless, and saving money by riding the rods between train cars or negotiating free rides from conductors in exchange for entertaining the train's waitstaff during their breaks. Ted's own big break came in early 1917 when, in New York City and playing with Arthur Stone's jazz band, he was recruited to front a jazz band at Rector's Restaurant. The owner of Rector's, Paul Salvin, had observed the recent success of the original Dixieland jazz band at rival Reisenweber's Restaurant, and he decided that Rector's should have something similar. The band was under the nominal leadership of Rector's musical director, Earl Fuller, but it was really Ted who called the shots. On person and in record, Earl Fuller's jazz band enjoyed phenomenal success, and a year later, Ted was lured to the Baltabarin to lead a band under his own name. Executives at Columbia Records, perhaps disappointed to have missed the opportunity to sign the original Dixieland jazz band, reached out to Ted and signed him to a contract that would ultimately extend to 14 years. Though the terms were modest at first, by 1929, his Columbia contract called for Ted to be paid $3,500 per side, plus generous royalties per record sold, in addition to receiving top billing and Columbia promotional materials. The first two selections I'd like to play for you are samples from test pressings in the Ted Lewis Museum's collection. They demonstrate not only Ted's abilities as a decent saxophonist who could improvise, but comparison with the issued takes of the same selections reveals the surprising looseness and informality with which Ted's early records were made. Far from being heavily arranged, tightly rehearsed performances, a number of musical elements, from changing lyrics to extraneous whoops and shouts to improvised solos to the musical arrangements themselves, prove that much was spontaneous. First, let's listen to Beale Street Mama, a song by Roy Turk and J. Russell Robinson, recorded by Ted's band on April 17, 1923 in New York City. I'll begin by playing the introduction, followed by Ted's own C melody sax solo from the unissued first take, which, incidentally, was rejected because of a defect in the master. So here's that take one. Next, I'll play just Ted's solo from take four, the take that was issued at the time. After beginning similarly, he goes in a different direction, buoyed by Lou Raderman's rhythmic strumming of his violin that was absent from the first take. By take four, perhaps Ted thought things were becoming too lethargic. Thank you. Admittedly, it's still not the hottest thing ever, but it shows that Ted was at least a proficient improviser and maybe even a very good one. Even on the sax, he seems to imitate his clarinet style, complete with bending notes and swooping portamenti between them. Ted's record of I Like Pie, I Like Cake, But I Like You Best of All from December 1924 is perhaps a bit more fun. Not only does it find the band full of energy, but the unissued fourth take shows Ted interjecting whoops and shouts to drive things along. First, we'll hear take one. This is what Columbia issued in early 1925. Now let's hear Ted's opening vocal from take four, rejected when it failed to pass the wear test. I think you'll hear why. I love the whoops and even a dog bark in there. It's so subtle, you almost could miss it. I wish I had time to play the whole record, but I don't. So let's skip to the end and hear a sample of Ted's clarinet solo, full of acrobatic darts and weaves leading into the final rideout. Here, going back now, is the issued take one. Just Ted's clarinet. Just the clarinet from the take four, the unissued one. Cut it off, but we're pressed for time. I think it's safe to say Ted had some decent chops. Ted Lewis shot to fame almost overnight in 1919, and his star shone brightly throughout the 1920s. Realizing that his own style of playing the clarinet was becoming, if you'll pardon the pun, old hat by the end of the decade, he had peppered his band with such seasoned jazzmen as Muggsy Spanier, Jimmy Dorsey, Fats Waller, Benny Goodman, and others. Even Frank Teschmacher recorded with him on a few sessions in the early 1930s. With the presence of such illustrious sidemen, many have considered the mid-1920s to the early 30s to be the peak of his career. After the big names departed his band and after Columbia dropped his contract in 1933, it's easy to think of Ted by the middle of the decade as a has-been, but his busy touring schedule, appearances in films, and body of instantaneous recordings suggest otherwise. The mid to late 1930s represent a fascinating time in Ted's career, unfortunately a period poorly documented on commercial recordings and long neglected by most researchers. Despite a general downturn in the entertainment industry during the Great Depression that ended the careers of many of his band-leading contemporaries, Ted remained a strong attraction in theaters and nightclubs. In March 1931, Ted and his band began a 10-week tour of Lowe's picture houses at a salary of $8,500 per week. to that time the largest salary ever paid by the theater chain for such a tour. Shortly after the tour began, paint and varnish manufacturer Valspar offered to sponsor radio broadcasts of Ted's Lowe's appearances, and for an additional $4,000 a week, his band was heard over the NBC network from wherever he happened to be performing. By 1934, Variety magazine noted of 44-year-old Ted Lewis that, quote, his hair is graying at the temples, but he has lost none of his versatility. In addition to theater shows, his band played one-night stands in ballrooms, commanding $1,500 a night. Here's a fun story. In Salem, Massachusetts, his band played for a dawn dance on September 2, 1934. In that puritanical town, Sunday dancing was prohibited, so the dance started at 12:05 a.m. on Monday morning and went until 4 a.m. As I mentioned a moment ago, Ted made his final records for Columbia in July of 1933, ending a steady and prolific 14-year association with the label. Even before his departure from Columbia, he was producing proto-swing records like Rhythm and Here You Come With Love that show the band moving to ever more driving and sophisticated arrangements, propelled by the band's new string bassist, Jimmy Moore. After a year's hiatus from the recording studio, Ted and his band, with a substantially revised lineup, returned to make records for Jack Capp's fledgling Decca label in August 1934. Mark Beresford has noted that on selections like Jazznocracy, White Heat, and the unissued Earthquake, the band sounds very un-Lewis-like, Ted experimenting with tighter arrangements and a more modern vein modeled on the Casa Loma Orchestra with touches of Jimmy Lunsford. Traces of the old Ted Lewis remain on records like Pop Goes Your Heart, where he sings and plays clarinet, but for the most part, the Decca sessions in the autumn of 1934 reveal a very polished, modern sounding for the time band, largely free from the sentimentality and nostalgic trappings that would become his trademark in later years. In a moment, I'll play a selection from a 1938 live broadcast heard over the Mutual Don Lee Broadcasting System. It originated at Topsy's Cafe in Southgate, California, about 20 miles south of Los Angeles. Ted and his entourage were in California for the summer months, following a typically busy winter and spring. For much of 1937 and 1938, Variety reported a shortage of name bands to fill the nation's theaters, ballrooms, and nightclubs. To Ted's advantage, competition among such venues, both big and small, was fierce to attract nationally known talent. Ted and his group spent January and February touring theaters and nightclubs in the Midwest, from Milwaukee to Indianapolis to Minneapolis to Omaha, before swinging back east via Cincinnati, Dayton, Cleveland, Erie, and Pittsburgh. If we can believe the glowing reports that appeared in the trade journals, he consistently played to capacity crowds, bringing in as much as $23,000 per venue. His one-hour stage program of the time, crafted over decades in vaudeville, was described by both Variety and Billboard. Don't forget, Ted's origins were in vaudeville, and he remained a very visual and theatrically minded performer. On an elaborate stage, attractively lit, Ted greeted the audience singing something called History of Music, in which he traced the evolution of swing. His second number, Have You Got Any Castles, Baby, was followed by a tap dance by Loretta Lane, which in turn led to Gay Dixon singing Swing, Brother, Swing. Following some comedic banter with Charles Snowball Whittier, Whittier and Betty Dickerson launched into a tap dance duet. The program also featured a comedy song by Lewis called He's the Leader of the Band, and an adagio act by Sylvia Manon that reportedly evoked gasps from the audience. In case you're not familiar, in vaudeville, adagio acts were acrobatic dances usually involving a man and a woman. The woman assumed graceful postures as she was lifted, tossed, dipped, spread, and carried. Sounds rough. Ray Royce, dressed in a tuxedo and high hat, performed a skit as a drunk, showing off his acrobatic ability in falls and head flips. And Whittier joined Ted for their famous Me and My Shadow routine, by that time a 12-year staple in which Whittier mimicked Ted's every movement. Another longtime staple of the show involving Ted was him tossing peanuts into the audience and to the accompaniment of his band playing the peanut vendor. As a side note, while in Omaha in February 1938, Ted estimated that over the prior 10 years, he had thrown out 260,000 pounds of peanuts at a cost of $26,000. More swing music ensued with the pop song Bémir Bis Duchesne, then Ted closed the show with that old feeling. With only minor alterations, Ted and his company of performers presented the same basic show wherever they played for much of early 1938. Ted liked to run a tight ship, and the program was timed and planned to the smallest detail, and Ted objected loudly and publicly when a Connecticut theater tried to tack on several amateur acts following the end of his programs that April. On May 14, 1938, Ted's mother died in Circleville at age 78. He seems to have taken the next few weeks off before opening with the Ted Lewis Rhythm Review at the Paramount Theater in Los Angeles the week of June 13th. The Los Angeles Times commented that, quote, two generations know and like Ted Lewis, an unusual feat since many noted favorites appear and disappear quickly these days. He has changed a bit with the times, of course. His patter now includes such terms as swing, jam, and the like. But his opening number makes it clear that tomorrow something new will turn up, that music is the thing. After a week at the Paramount, Ted and company moved 20 miles south to Topsy's Cafe, where we join him now. The full 30-minute program, broadcast June 29, 1938, and recorded on 8 12-inch sides, finds Ted and his band before a lively crowd mixing moderate tempo popular songs like Swing Low, Swing High, and You Leave Me Breathless with a few slower, nostalgic throwbacks. In the middle of the program, the band rips through Gershwin's Oh Lady Be Good with such fire and punch that was largely absent 2 weeks later when Ted and his band made their first commercial recordings in 4 years. It's a far cry from When My Baby Smiles at Me. Admittedly, it's a song that was already 14 years old in 1938, but Ted Lewis revives it with one of the better swing treatments I've heard. And let's take a listen now.
And here we are for the last half of the program. Lady Be Good. Come on, behave yourself, honey. Come on now.
I'd like to call your attention to the clarinet solo that comes halfway through the performance. It's timid sounding and rhythmically stiff in stark contrast to the fluid driving trombone solo. Richard Johnson and Bernard Shirley in American Dance Bands on Record and Film report that Tony Parenti was with Ted Lewis in 1938 and 39, but this clearly isn't him. The clarinetist doesn't share the confidence of his fellow reedmen. His tone quivers a bit and he fluffs a few runs. Some might even call the repeated figurations corny. Although it represents a departure from his signature gas-piped clarinet style, I suggest that it's Ted Lewis himself trying to modernize his sound a bit. He's no Benny Goodman or Artie Shaw, but at nearly 50 years old, I have to give credit to an old dog learning new tricks. Let's listen to just the beginning of that solo again.
Thank you.
going to skip over this next part because we're running low on time, but I do want to play you just a little snippet of a performance from 1946 where Ted is still fronting a swing band and Philadelphia broadcasting over the Mutual Broadcasting System from WIP and the Latin Casino in Philadelphia. And just take a moment to listen to a few seconds of On the Alamo.
Very nice, ladies, very nice. That was the Reed Sisters, and now, ladies and gentlemen, the band in On the Alamo. Hit it, boys.
A string of solos follow. They're all wonderful, but we're running low on time, so some other time. Far from vanishing from the entertainment scene following the worst of the Great Depression, Ted Lewis not only survived, but thrived. Even as his commercial records and film appearances downplayed his jazz sensibilities to promote the wistful medicine man for the blues, in person and on the air, Ted continually sought new talent and adapted to newer trends in jazz music. Following World War II, with the onset of the Red Scare and as the harsh realities of living in the atomic age set in, many Americans found themselves longing for the past. Swing was passé, nostalgia became big business, and Ted Lewis, ever the savvy entertainer, obliged. Except to pull out his clarinet for the occasional revival of Tiger Rag, Ted by his 60s and his audiences seemed content for more leisurely strolls through memory lane. Still, for Ted, the jazz clarinetist and bandleader, the flame burned brighter and longer than has widely been acknowledged as he worked to make everybody happy. Thank you. Thank you. And if I can put in just a quick plug, I have one last quick slide here I forgot to mention. This is the CD I mentioned earlier. Shameless self-promotion here. This will be coming out next month if you're at all interested. This is the one to look for. Thank you.